History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, we've learned, if we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions and, of course, take the time to patiently listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This episode and the one before it were both recorded at the National Museum of World War II Aviation in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And maybe you're saying, hey, I've been to Colorado Springs. I haven't been to that museum. Well, maybe you didn't know it was there. It might be because it's one of the newest museums, only open to the public since 2012. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard us talk to World War II veterans at quite a few different museums and memorials around the country. From San Diego to Las Cruces and Lubbock, places like Julesburg, Colorado, Ruston, Louisiana, of course, Washington, D.C., and I guess I can't list them all, but all over our country, there are people dedicated to keeping this kind of history alive. And each one of these special places can give you a little bit different perspective. One of the things that makes the National Museum of World War II Aviation in Colorado Springs unique is that the planes in its collection actually fly. I have some photos from the museum posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you happen to see the museum's B-25 with In the Mood painted on the nose, you probably wouldn't realize that you may have seen it before. If you saw the film Pearl Harbor, it was that very B-25 flying off the deck of an aircraft carrier in that movie's recreation of the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo. I'm sure you would not be surprised to know that you can learn all about the Doolittle Raid at the National Museum of World War II Aviation, but you might be surprised to learn that the man who flew that B-25 off the carrier in that film was none other than the museum's president and CEO, Bill Clares. During any given visit, you may stumble across Bill checking out progress on the active rebuild projects inside the museum's Westpac restoration hangar. Other airworthy aircraft that you'll find there include a P-38 Lightning, a P-47 Thunderbolt, an F-4U Corsair, and an SBD Dauntless Dive Bomber, among others. I have a link to the museum's website up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. They're open there Wednesday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and of course, World War II veterans always get in free. You actually heard from one of those World War II veterans on our last episode. Bill Roach told you about the two crash landings he survived in B-17s before becoming a prisoner of war. But we didn't have time to include Bill's comments about the National Museum of World War II Aviation.
Well, I appreciate the fact that they're very realistic. I mean, it's an authentic museum. All of the artifacts and all of everything they have here is authentic. And they're trying to get a B-17, I understand, but I don't know if they're going to get one. You've probably toured it. You know what they have here, so I think they've done a great job. I was here when we dug the dirt for this thing. Now I know they're going to build another hangar. I've been in a lot of museums. I go to our reunions, and we always go to the museum. Of course, the one in Dayton is the biggest, and there are a lot of museums all over the United States, and I think this compares favorably with some of them.
What does it mean to you that history that you and so many others lived in World War II is being preserved this way?
Well, it means a lot. It means a lot because I occasionally talk to some students and they don't know a thing about World War II, much less the 8th Air Force. Hopefully when Spielberg's thing comes out, we might know a little bit more about the 8th Air Force. But right now, you talk to people and unless they come to the museum and they give them a nice briefing here, tell them about how everything went, in the air war in Europe and so forth. But I know, I think they're doing a really, really good job here.
Again, that is Bill Roach. And if you missed his story last time, you can pull it up, of course, at hometownheroesradio.com. And, you know, you don't have to wait for Steven Spielberg's miniseries, Masters of the Air, to come out to learn about the 8th Air Force or any other aspect of aviation during World War II. Just go to Colorado Springs, spend a day at the museum. Mark Schaefer spends a lot of days at that museum, and some of the items in their extensive gift shop are actually his handiwork. Mark is also a volunteer with Honor Flight of Southern Colorado, part of the National Honor Flight Network, which hopes to again start taking veterans to their memorials in Washington, D.C. this fall. Mark Schaefer is the one who brought Bill Roach and the young lady we're going to hear from in a bit, Betty Dengis, to the museum to share their stories, both with you on the radio and with the stream of visitors pouring into the museum.
What have you learned from all these World War II veterans that you've interacted with through Honor Flight Southern Colorado and here at the National Museum of World War II Aviation?
Wow. They're probably the toughest. Not only are they the greatest generation, but they're probably the toughest generation because these guys are born during the Depression. They grew up during poverty, and I don't know if they ever, I wonder if they could ever see a year ahead or a month ahead and said, you know, are we ever going to get out of this? And then just as things start to get better, suddenly we're in a world war for our very existence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to go through that, you must be awfully tough. And so they're the toughest generation as well as the greatest.
And with Honor Flight Southern Colorado, you've taken so many of them to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. Why is that mission so important? Why do you guys keep doing that as volunteers to create this opportunity for veterans?
You know, when we build in our nation's capital a monument to honor the men and women that have done so much for our country, and so many of them that would not be able to go on their own, don't have the financial means to go. It is just amazing to take these people there and see American people standing, applauding, talking to them, thanking them, honoring them. It's just, they deserve it. And to be able to watch that, to me, is the best, my favorite moment. I just stand back and let America say, talk to these people.
As long as I've been doing this show, I've caught a lot of flack from the veterans that I interview because the name of the show is Hometown Heroes, and they say, well, I'm not a hero. The heroes are the ones who didn't come home. And I understand you've had a lot of conversations along those lines, and it even caused you to come up with a T-shirt that helps raise money for Honor Flight Southern Colorado and is available here at the National Museum of World War II Aviation.
Yes.
Tell me that sentiment that you came up with and what the thinking behind it is.
So I've been to a number of World War II, five World War II cemeteries, American Battle Monument cemeteries in Europe, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Italy, Anzio. And when I was walking through Anzio, we all know that these men and women, and there are some women there, have died at a very young age. But when I was at Anzio, I realized every single person in here, the thousands of people in here, died a fearful, violent death. And I thought, you know, we have an obligation to the soldier who didn't come home to honor the veteran who did. And I've tried to live my life by that. Some people try to change that saying, I'm sticking to it. That's how I feel. That's how I'm going to live it. Someday maybe they'll put that in my tombstone. And hopefully they'll add the words, he did.
And I know we don't have time to talk about all the things you've done for these veterans, but here at the museum, there are a few pieces of evidence of that, the shirts that are available and support those causes. And there are a bunch of little vials of sand, and some of them are places you just mentioned, like Anzio, like Omaha Beach, battles in the Pacific like Iwo Jima, Guam, Tinian. Why do you do that?
It's hallowed ground. You know, every time I pick up one of those vials, I wonder if there isn't a little American DNA in some of that sand.
Mm.
And it kind of hits the heart thinking, you know what? The men and women, some people, their lives ended here. They went into, fundamentally I can say I understand what they went through, but I'm so thankful that I have no comprehension of what a soldier goes through in combat. And they are heroes. If they tell me they're not a hero, I won't accept that answer. I tell them, you know, some say they don't feel like a hero, and I say there's no emotion tied with being a hero. It's not how you feel. It's how we feel about you. And some will say, I'm not a hero. The guy who didn't come home was a hero. That is absolutely true, but you don't have to die to be a hero. And then some will say, you know, I'm just not a hero, and I will say, you don't get to choose my heroes.
And with respect to Honor Flight Southern Honor Flight Southern Colorado, if somebody listening wants to support that mission, wants to help more veterans go see their memorials, wants to participate in some way, whether it's financial or volunteering their time, What's the best way for them to do that?
Well, they can go to our website, honorflightsoco.org. We have a website that will explain, I hope it explains a lot of what we have available. We have volunteer positions. They can also use a phone number they can call. They can leave a message. The president of our Honor Flight says he checks the messages twice a day. And he is very responsible and very good about getting back to people. And we would love to have him. We meet once a month, usually the third Thursday of the month. And we talk about Honor Flight. And, you know, it's an amazing thing we're doing. Earl Morse was so right on, spot on when he said, we need to get these people to D.C. Wouldn't it be a shame if these memorials in D.C. are there? And if you're building them in the Capitol, and yet the people that they were built for never got the opportunity to see them. That would not be, I think Abraham Lincoln said, a nation that doesn't honor its veterans will not endure. How many hundred and some years ago? And that still stands today. I think he's right. I just thank everybody that does support Honor Flight, anybody out there that supported Honor Flight, whatever chapter, whatever hub. We are not in competition with each other. It is amazing that it's like a giant family. In Colorado Springs, you know, they say that there's 4,300 nonprofit organizations here. And that may be true for many other cities as well, but I don't know of any volunteer organization that is anything close to what Honor Flight does. So you may have a lot of ones for blindness, for deafness, for people with various disabilities, and they're all great organizations, don't get me wrong. But there's probably only one organization in your area that does what Honor Flight does. So I hope that America steps up. It's very hard always to ask people for money. It's not an easy thing to do. But when you think about what you're doing, it really makes it a lot easier. So I hope we can get people to support our hubs.
That is Mark Schaefer with Honor Flight Southern Colorado. And I'm going to give you a phone number. We don't do this very often, but if you'd like one of those shirts that he designed with that quote, I have an obligation to the soldier who didn't come home to honor the veteran who did, those shirts are in the gift shop at the National Museum of World War II Aviation. But if you can't make it there and you'd still like to order one of those shirts, you can call this number, area code 719-205-0003. I'll say it one more time, 719-205-0003. I also have a photo of that shirt at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also find a photo of an exhibit that certainly grabbed my attention. It memorializes the Flying Greek, Colonel Steve Pisanos, complete with a life-size likeness of the legendary pilot. There are photos and narratives, but we had the chance to hear some of that from Colonel Pisanos himself a few years ago on this program. He passed away in 2016, but what an incredible story he had. Steve snuck his way to America on a merchant ship before World War II. He flew Spitfires in one of the RAF Eagle squadrons before getting into the cockpit of P-51s. And this colorful ace had more than his fair share of aerial encounters with German fighter planes.
FW-190s, enemy 109s. I shot down 10 of them. Mm-hmm. 6 FW-190s and 4 ME-109s. And funny, you know, years later, after the war, I met Adolf Galland, a German great guy, you know. And so he was asking me, and you shot down the ME? Oh, I said, yes, General. And wonderful guy, absolutely superb.
10 planes claimed makes you a double ace.
Correct.
But you're over there flying for the Royal Air Force against these German fighters. I imagine you had more than your share of close calls.
Oh, my God, quite a bit, yeah.
What stands out in your mind? If people read your book, what are the ones they're going to say, holy moly, is that the truth?
After 106 missions, I was on an escort mission down to Bordeaux, France, and we got into a fight there. I sat down three of the guys there, and, of course, on the way back, I lost my engine flying a P-51, and I crash-landed south of Le Havre, about 25, 30 kilometers. The Germans came after me. I was trying to put fire on my crashed Mustang, and they began to fire over my head all over the place. And I got so scared, I dropped everything, and I ran, and I got into a forest. They came into the forest, and it was then how I more or less lost them. And for 5 days, I wandered all over the countryside with an injured shoulder, and then about 5 days later, I made contact with the resistance. Thank God I had learned French in high school in Athens, but I never really thought that I would speak French in America, you know, but it came handy, you know, at that time, and I'll never forget one of my Frenchman friends, you know, he told the other guy, he said, Le Grec American parle français. You know, the Greek American speaks French. And they took care of me so wonderful. And I got decorated by Charles de Gaulle with two kisses when I was given the French Croix de Guerre. And about 3-4 years ago, I got a letter from the American Embassy in Washington. Dear Colonel Pisanos, the government in Paris discovered that you contributed immensely for our liberation, and they have awarded you the Legion of Honor, the highest French decoration. They wanted to know whether I could go to Washington to be decorated. I told them that I couldn't make it. They came out here, and they presented me with the decoration at the museum in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unbelievable. There were more people and friends and everybody.
I imagine you received some pretty heady decorations from our government as well.
Oh, yeah.
During the war.
I got 5 DFCs and the Legion of Merit with 2 clusters. And
5 Distinguished Flying Crosses, no big deal. You mentioned that incident. After 106 missions between flying the Spitfires with the RAF and flying American fighters, you're in a P-51, you're shot up, and you brought it in for a crash landing. Did you think about trying to bail out at any point?
Well, I tried to, but I was having difficulties when I decided not to bail out in high altitude because the Germans were really shooting at anybody coming down in a parachute. So I decided to wait until I get lower, but then as I tried to unstrap myself, you know, I was so goddamn close to the ground, and I had stepped out on the from the cockpit, and I was just ready to, you know, when the aircraft was to hit the ground, you know, try to. But thank God, the right wing hit the ground. The aircraft twisted to the right a little bit, and I was thrown way, just missing the prop, the stop prop, you know. And how long I stood right there, you know, lying on my back, and I looked up in the sky, and I said, my God, I said, my shoulder, and so on. And it was then when the Germans evidently had spotted me and followed the aircraft, you know, when I crash-landed.
So you weren't even at the controls when you crash-landed.
Oh, yeah.
You were standing.
I was standing outside the cockpit.
Trying to jump.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, my book has the photo on the outside of the book. Mm-hmm. Shows how I'm standing out by the cockpit, outside the cockpit.
Uh-huh. I've seen that photo, and I'll make sure it's on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. So you jump off, you're banged up, you're injured, but the Germans are still shooting at you.
Yeah, and when I saw the bullets flying all over my head, you know, I decided to drop everything, forget about burning the aircraft, you know, and I began to run. And thank God I was close to the forest there, and that's when I got into the forest. And they came along too, and I lost them in the forest, of course. And for 5 days, I wandered all over the countryside, and I drank water from running creeks, and I found a farm, you know, that had cabbage in my gut. I ate a whole cabbage one day. I was so hungry and scared and injured and so on. And until later on, I made contact with the French.
Right, so this French resistance, the underground, gets you out of there. And then did you go back to flying?
No. When Paris was liberated and some 800 Americans came out from hiding, B-17 guys and fighter pilots, of course, we were all brought back to England, and I went back to my unit, but they wouldn't let me fly. So I was returned to the States, and I was assigned to Dayton, Ohio at Wright Field.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I went through test pilot school with Yeager and Don Gentile and all those guys. And I took a good part in testing the P-80, the first jet we had at Muroc Lake.
I think people are getting the idea from your cross-Atlantic journey that you're plotting and no one else knows about, that you're going to jump off in America, to going over to fly for the British, to all these missions for the British and the Americans, to then back as a test pilot. It doesn't seem like you're afraid of much.
No.
Where does that come from?
I don't know. I don't know. The Greek blood or something.
The late, great Steve Pisanos, whose legacy is preserved at the National Museum of World War II Aviation in Colorado Springs. When we come back, another veteran I had the privilege of meeting at the museum. She is one of 300,000 American women who served in uniform during the war. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down. 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes. sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode recorded at the National Museum of World War II Aviation in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where July 4th will be a very special day. Well, Independence Day is a special day wherever you are, but the museum is going to be marking the occasion with Outside Photo Day, positioning some of its most popular planes outdoors in the Rocky Mountain sunshine so you can pose for pictures. At hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of a veteran I had the privilege of meeting at the museum, 98-year-old Betty Denges, an Army nurse who, believe it or not, is not the oldest World War II veteran in her family. Her older sister joined the Navy during the war and served in the waves. As usual, we're going to start out with the early years before World War II.
My dad was going to law school with Harry Truman, and he was working at Montgomery Ward, and they sent him to Denver to open that new building on South Broadway and get it going with all the necessary things. And so we moved to Denver, and we lived in Denver then for a couple of years. And actually, my younger sister was born there. My older sister and I were put in a junior league preventorium. This was for children who were undernourished and susceptible to tuberculosis, because tuberculosis was a big thing out here.
Yeah.
Lots of people came here for tuberculosis. But anyway, we think the school nurse put us in there because we don't remember who put us in that place, and we lived there, I think, about 6 months. And my sister fell off the slide and broke her arm. So then my dad was back in Kansas City, so he came back out and took us back to Missouri.
That kind of sounds like a traumatic experience for a kid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then we lived in Independence and with my grandmother, and my dad, as I said, was going to school, so he graduated and began a law practice, and then he and my mother got divorced at that point in time. I think I must have been 8. She went to business school, so then eventually she went back to Ohio and lived there with her mother, and she took my little sister with her. So I remember, you know, living around with aunts and uncles, but we eventually began to stay with my dad in the wintertime and my mother in the summertime. And that was fun. We rode buses back there because, well, we didn't think about flying. I don't know if they ever thought about flying us, but of course we didn't. So that was different. But we did get to know the families on each side quite well because of all that.
Did you have an idea in your mind of, hey, when I grow up, these are some things that I'm going to do? Or
yes, I always wanted to be a nurse.
Why was that?
Well, I'm not sure. My father's older sister was a nurse in nurse's training, and she contracted spinal meningitis, I think it was, and died. I didn't really ever know her very much, but I knew that who she was and that she was a nurse. I don't know why, but I just wanted to be a nurse. I knew that I didn't have to figure anything out or anything, because I just knew I wanted to be a nurse.
Hmm.
And so when I graduated from high school in Kansas City, I went back to Ohio, and I went to this hospital school, and they said, "You're too young. Can't enroll you. You're only 16. So they said, "Come back next year." So I went to the junior college in Kansas City for a semester. Oh, did things like debate and typing and shorthand and those things. I went back to the school the next summer, and even though I was 17 at that point, because my birthday was in November, they did enroll me, and I got to start. So I really enjoyed every bit of my nursing career, my schooling. This school was excellent in what they taught us. I thought we had such a good, sound basis in medicine and everything. So I thought I was really well-grounded in my profession.
What was the name of the school?
Altman Hospital.
All right.
School of Nursing in Canton, Ohio. They have now melded with the junior college.
So did you finish that up before or after the attack on Pearl Harbor?
I had strep throat and I was in the hospital when Pearl Harbor happened. There was a little radio and I heard about that. And so that was one thing. But the Red Cross came and talked to our class and joined us in the Red Cross. And that was a commitment to join the military when we graduated. So we all knew about Pearl Harbor at that point, of course. And then we graduated. Almost all of my classmates went into the service, different Air Force and Navy and all. There were only a couple of us that didn't go in. And I had to work at the hospital while I waited to be 21 and take my state board exam and pass it, because it's what required to enlist in the Army. So when I did that, I waited a little bit because I thought, do I really want to go? Or I knew they needed nurses back home, too.
Sure.
Yeah, because they were short there at the hospital. So that was a good time for me because I went to the nursing office in the morning, and they would send me wherever they needed somebody. It gave me great opportunity to learn lots of things and to be confident in my ability to what I could do. So I've always been glad I had that opportunity. But then I decided that, yes, I should enlist. So I did. Was sent to Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis for basic training. Wherever we went, they would have us work in the wards with the patients. And so we did some there as during basic training of working on the wards with the patients. And so I always thought that was a good opportunity, too, to know where things were and to know the patients and things like that. But we did have kind of a typical basic training with marching and climbing the ropes and those things.
Mm-hmm.
And a test. I still have that test. You know, what were the ranks of, you know, all the military stuff was on there.
Ah. And when you say the patients in the ward, mm-hmm. were those guys who had come home from the war?
I think so.
And how did you feel about the idea of maybe going overseas?
I didn't even think of it. I guess I knew that was a possibility, but I just didn't even think about it. Well, then they assigned us out different places. There were some of my classmates were in that group, and they went to different places. But I went to White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. The Greenbrier Hotel was Ashford General Hospital, mm-hmm. a 2,000-bed neurovascular surgical center. That's where we worked. We lived in the cottages. You know, this was a hotel. But we worked 12-hour night shift, two of us, over the whole hospital.
Wow.
In the daytime, we did split shifts, 7 to noon and 3 to 7. We were pretty, well, the warden men helped us a lot. They were kind of like nurse aides or CNAM. So they helped us a lot. We gave the medicine and that kind of thing.
Can you give us the profile of those patients or the kind of things they were dealing with?
They were dealing with, we had a paraplegic patient, had orthopedic broken bones and so forth. And I did have one that I have his picture. We were singing Christmas carols around his bed. He died the next day of a fat embolus.
Mm.
And that was a tragic thing. for him to die like that.
Had it been the war that left him in that condition?
Yes, uh-huh, because all of our patients were from the Battle of the Bulge and from that area, frozen feet.
Oh, yeah. My grandfather was a doctor in the Bulge, and he said he treated more frozen feet than anything else.
Yeah.
So these are guys who've been shipped home, and you're taking care of them in West Virginia.
Right.
But you're getting an up-close and personal experience with the price of freedom.
Yes.
What was that like for you emotionally to see the condition these guys were in?
Well, I think it was nursing. You know, that's what we were there to do. And that's what it was. Because those were the kind of patients you took care of.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at night that the guys would come up. I would be at the desk doing paperwork. They would come up and sit and talk to me about their experiences. And that was, I really liked that they did that because I think it was good for them and get that off their chest, as it were. But, you know, in a safe environment that they could talk about things. And
was it hard for you to hear some of the things they had to say?
No, because I was already a nurse.
Yeah.
Who listened. Yeah.
So you're trying to help heal their bodies, but you're also bringing some therapy to their souls and their hearts.
Right, because, you know, that was the thing you heard from them was, you know, the difficulty and the problems. And so I did hear a lot, and I don't remember much of that. And one thing, I really tried to remember everybody's name because I thought that was important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had wards of 100 men, and you know, that were in that. And as I said, they were my age. You know, they were like, I was 21, and they were, you know, eight. Well, they were younger.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them. But they were the same age I was. So, you know, we had that camaraderie, too, of being the same age. And
sure.
Of listening to that and hearing what was going on.
Was there something that, I know this is a generalized question and each patient would have been different, but was there something that you found that they really needed that you could do that would really be helpful for them?
I think the listening.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I would say the listening because I became a psychiatric nurse later in my career, but I really knew about those things and that they needed to be listened to and not told what to do or, you know, those kinds of things that people, giving advice is not good.
I know, you're 21 years old, you're wide-eyed and young. Did you have a sense for the significance of what you were doing and why it mattered?
I guess I did, but I think we just thought we were doing just what we needed to do. We was nursing, we were taking care of people who were ill in some way and or damaged. So that's, you just approached it that way, that you were the nurse that was helping them. And I guess that's what I got a lot of in my training, was that was the important part of nursing.
And how long did you stay there in West Virginia?
Let's see, I went in the fall, and in the spring, must have been February, we got orders to go overseas. We had a month off to go visit our families before we went overseas. So I did that. Visited my mother in Ohio and my dad he was in Kansas, I think, at that time. Then we reported to Fort Dix to be ready to go overseas. And we boarded the Île-de-France in New York Harbor. There were 500 nurses in the group that were going over to replace the nurses who had been there. So it was 8 days across the Atlantic. We zigzagged because there was a submarine, apparently. We didn't know about that, but apparently a submarine was following us. Yeah, but it was too big a ship to attack, so we didn't have any problems with that. Had one problem with seasickness the first morning out, but then we learned if we nibbled on hard biscuits or something that we wouldn't get seasick, so I never had any problems after that.
Had you ever been on a ship before that?
No. So anyway, we landed in Curragh, Scotland. to hear them say, the war is over. Now what are you going to do with us?
Well, Betty would find out there was still a lot of work to do and some adventures, too. How did she get a ride in a B-17? And how did she happen to meet the Pope? We'll hear the rest of this 98-year-old World War II nurse's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and another episode recorded at the National Museum of World War II Aviation in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Thanks again to Mark Schaefer of Honor Flight of Southern Colorado for introducing us to a couple more remarkable World War II veterans. When we left off, Betty Dengis had told us how she always wanted to become a nurse, how she followed those dreams and cared for wounded veterans stateside before heading overseas, only to arrive in Scotland just as Germany surrendered. By no means did that mean her work or her adventure would end.
Well, they sent us to southern England by Bath, a staging area again, and we lived in tents there. But again, we had time to travel. We went to Cheddar and Stratford and Bristol and London. That was very interesting.
And I don't want to gloss over that either. You say you land there, and they tell you the war is over.
Yeah.
That had to be pretty good news, right? Was there some celebration there?
Yes, I think we did celebrate, and we're really happy that. But then we also knew what was going to happen to us, so there was that part of it too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when they sent us to the staging area in southern England there. As I said, they always had these trips. The trips were for the enlisted men,
mm-hmm,
because they didn't want them sitting around getting into mischief, so they would arrange these trips. And most people would go on the trip. A lot of the nurses didn't go on trips, so my roommate and I began to go together and do things together. So I did get to Cardiff, Wales.
Mm.
And my grandmother was from Wales.
Wow.
So that was interesting. I didn't get to the place where she was from, but it was good to get into Wales to say I'd been there.
Yeah.
She was from Llanelli in Swansea. So anyway, we joined this hospital, 94th General, and they had just gotten sent away all of their patients. They were getting ready to go to France. So right away, we got ready to go to France and went across the channel, landed in Le Havre, took a train, stopped in London. The fun thing there was we had to go to the bathroom and we didn't have any money, and you had to pay to get into the bathroom. So the enlisted men had been paid, so they had money, so they paid our way into the bathroom.
The things we take for granted.
Yes. And somebody who was ahead of me said, oh, you know, and I said, what, you know. She said, oh, you'll find out. So I went into the bathroom, and it was the two steps that you stand on and squat.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And so that was a real learning experience. And many more, though. So anyway, that was funny. So then we got back on the train and we went to Reims, two little towns, Mormelon-le-Petit and Mormelon-le-Grand. And we set up some tents there because that's what we were doing. All of us were around at different places. I don't know what the process was or anything, but we would take care of patients whenever we were in any place where they had patients. So we would work, and I was... You know, it was okay. Because we kept busy too.
And so the war is over.
Uh huh.
But there's still a stream of patients coming in. Guys evacuated, wounded.
Right.
What can you tell us about the kind of condition they were in?
Well, at that point, they had been taken pretty good care of in the front, in the MASH units,
right,
as it were. And so they would be bound up, and legs were taken care of. The one man who I said died from the fat embolus, he had a fracture of his femur. He was strung up in a traction.
Mm.
And that's one reason he died, was fat embolus. But those kinds of things, the orthopedic things, people would be on crutches or in wheelchairs and all of that. All the same, just nursing.
But did that weigh on you, knowing what they were facing? What kind of futures they're looking at?
No, I just accepted it.
Mm.
It was just nursing, what we did,
mm-hmm.
Take care of sick patients. And I would, you know, I did wonder what happened to them. We did, back at the hospital in West Virginia, we did golf with some of the guys, some of the patients, and things like that. That was fun. And then we danced. We danced a lot. Of course, because I was a first lieutenant. I was second lieutenant, and then I was promoted to first lieutenant. We went to the officers' club, and I remember this one dance. The officers invited the enlisted men because they didn't get to be with to dance with the nurses and all.
Right.
And so they danced, and I remember my roommate said about that dance, she remembered we flew from arm to arm.
I would imagine that, you know, being an Army nurse around all those men,
mm-hmm.
many of whom, a lot of your patients probably
right.
hadn't seen very many females for a long time.
Yeah,
so
right.
You were probably pretty popular.
Yes, very. They loved the women. And we loved the men. We really enjoyed the dancing with them. That was really wonderful. So anyway, there we are in Mormelon, and we are put with this general hospital, 227th General Hospital, and we were headed down through France to Marseille to wait for a ship to take us to the Philippines.
Ah, because the war's still going over there.
Yeah, that's beginning of the Riviera, you know, so we would go up to the Riviera and Cannes, enjoy the sunshine and people we met. We met a lot of pilots who were from different places. One particular man I remember, they were from south of Rome in Marseillaise. They said, if you ever get down our way, give us a call. Well, as it turned out, there was a trip to Rome, a compassionate trip you could have if you had somebody, like if I had a boyfriend, which I did, or a family member or something, you could take this trip, but nobody signed up for it. And so the chief nurse said, who would like to go to Rome? Well, who would like to go to Rome? Of course, Barbara, her name was Barbara, my roommate and I. So we were signed up to go and packed up and took off. We went to Nice.
Uh-huh.
Took a ship across to Leghorn, the Leaning Tower of Pisa and everything, saw that. Our problem there was there were no bathrooms. And we couldn't tell the men. We tried to use all kinds of words that we thought might mean bathroom. But no, no. What she did was go out in the field. So we found that we didn't, there were no bathrooms. So we got to Rome and a hotel. We had a nice hotel there. We did a lot of sightseeing, going places and doing things. Went to the Vatican and saw lots of things at the Vatican. Their jewelry, yes, really valuable things. And one thing that happened that was just extra special, my friend was Catholic. But we got in a big room where they were having a, well, not a mass, but just he was talking to people.
Uh-huh.
And it was really full, filled with people. But we somehow got along the railing at the front right there. And he came down and walked along the railing and blessed us and all of this. And she was so, she kissed his ring.
This was the Pope?
Yeah, the Pope, uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
So we got to see him face to face, and she got to kiss his rings, which she was so thrilled with. And but I was just thrilled to meet somebody face to face. So that was really extra special. We could have been in the back of that room where we wouldn't have been close to him at all, but we were right there, so that was good. So anyway, we called these guys that had said, you know, if you did down here, why give us a call? The one guy wasn't there, but there was another one there, a couple others. He said, we're going to Athens for the weekend. Over the weekend, would you like to go with us? So they came to up to Rome and got us, put us on their plane, and off we went to Athens for the weekend. And we had a great time. Got up to the Parthenon and all of those, you know.
Well, you got a lot more than you signed up for, didn't you?
Yes, uh-huh. So anyway, we, you know, just had a little bit of, the soldiers were marching, and we got to see them in their costumes, you know, and all of that. And so we really did quite a bit over the weekend and then went back to Rome. They flew us back to Marcinese and then back to Rome. We were there for 2 weeks. It was a 2 week, which is, you know, a long time.
Yeah.
And we had a chance to call home, which we hadn't had a phone call anywhere for a long time. So that was nice to just be able to hear their voices. So then we went back to Marcia. We went back to work, and somebody had broken into our foot lockers and stolen a bunch of our stuff. But nothing you could do about that. I had a beautiful evening gown that I have a picture of. And I really liked that evening gown, and they stole it.
Mm.
I don't remember what else particularly, but too bad they knew we were gone. And
yeah.
So anyway, back to work.
How long did you stay over there?
9 months. We had another trip, a three-day pass to Paris. So we went out to the airport and said, do you have anything going to Paris? And they said, well, that B-17 there is gone. So they put us on board, and we flew to Paris on a B-17.
Not everybody gets to do that.
Yeah. So
where'd you sit?
In the bubble.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was raining and the weather was bad. They weren't flying back, so we had to go back on the train, which was an experience in and of itself.
Uh-huh.
You know, the trains were different. And then there was another trip that was a leave, which people didn't want to use their leaves, you know.
Right.
But we did, and it was skiing in Alpe d'Huez. We said, well, we'll go and we'll learn to ski. So we did ski, but we didn't learn much. But anyway, that was fun. Then eventually, everybody was signed up for Switzerland. So eventually our name came up. We went through several places in Switzerland, and we at one place, Kandersteg, we took skiing lessons from this skiing pro, and that was fun. He said, oh, we're going to learn how to go over the bumps. What do you call them?
The moguls?
The moguls, yeah.
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 Boy, so, you packed a lot into those nine months
yes.
over there.
Oh, and we ice skated too, because I loved ice skating.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And let me go back, because one of the first trips we, after we got to Marseille, we went was to Carcassonne and Lourdes. And, of course, Lourdes was very interesting. I've got a picture of, like, 300 guys, and Barbara and I said, Barbara and I and 300 of our friends went on this trip.
Uh-huh. Oh. And did you continue in nursing after the war?
Yes, and actually, what we thought, we were going to Germany to fight the Russians. So we were surprised then when she got orders to go to Austria and I got sent home. I was discharged. I chose not to stay, and I went back to my hospital, and I was then the supervisor of the students. And so I've stayed there for a while. Then that's when my sister and I decided we would go to college and went to Boulder. She met her husband, lived in Boulder the rest of her life. Well, she lives in Longmont now.
You've gotten to go to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
with Honor Flight. What did that experience mean to you?
Oh, it was wonderful, because I hadn't seen any of those things. And the one I really liked was the nurses one. Do you know the nurses one?
The Women in Military Service for America Memorial?
Yeah, uh-huh. And they're holding the GI.
Yeah.
Looking for the plane. We had guardians. Do you know about the system guardians?
Mm-hmm.
And she bought me a little replica of that nurse's.
Oh, beautiful.
And I have it on my shelf in my room.
What did you think about when you were at the National World War II Memorial and they have all those gold stars?
Yes. Oh, isn't that, to think each one of those represents a person is astounding. Yeah.
You know, from spending time with those patients, the ones that were back here in the States had been sent home from the war, the ones that you saw in Europe as well. Is there something that you think the rest of us should know about them, the kind of people they were, what they represent?
Yes, I had a psychiatric ward of 100 men there in Marseille. A lot of them, in fact, I think our ward officer said this, if they had never gone to war, if they had just stayed home on the farm, they would never have had any problems. You know, they would have just lived a normal life with no problems.
Mm-hmm.
But with the war disrupting their life and coming into all of this, they had psychiatric problems.
And that still happens today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there were challenges that you faced, but it kind of sounds like your experience in the Army Nurses Corps in World War II was a life-changing adventure for you.
Oh, yes.
Is there something that you would say you're most proud of, you're most thankful for?
Well, the opportunity. I guess I'd say the opportunity to do that, to take care of those men, and to have the opportunity to see the places that we were able to go to and see.
And is there anything you think, those of us who didn't live through that time in our history,
yeah,
is there something we need to understand about what America was like then?
What do we say now? Peace? We want peace. I think about the wars that we're having now, just really, why do we have to have this and kill these people and these young people? Again, young people. Couldn't we somehow learn to live together in harmony?
What keeps you going at age 98?
Oh, friends, family. I have two other friends. We've been writing these books for 30 years, care plan books for nurses, and they've been very successful. That's been real something I'm proud of, because I had the opportunity to put words in the books that are, words mean something.
Yeah.
And you can say, like, I'll give you the example. We say, well, how did that make you feel? No, it didn't make you feel. You felt that way.
Mm.
Yeah, see, and it's just those kinds of, In fact, there are therapeutic words in psych. But then the other thing I got into was parenting, because I decided I'm tired of taking care of people who were sick. I wanted to do preventive work. And I found this program, PET, it's called. It's a wonderful program about parenting. And it says the words we use, we have to be careful. You know, how do you talk to your children? And actually, those are the same kind of words that were in the therapeutic ones in psych. And I taught then at Bethel College, Bethel School, and I taught med-surg and psych.
Maybe there's some people listening right now who are nurses now or who want to be nurses when they're older. What's your number one piece of advice for being a good nurse?
Find a good school. You have to learn to appreciate people, to recognize that they are people, and they're there really to learn about how to interact with them in a positive way.
And what do you enjoy about coming out here to the National Museum of World War II Aviation?
Listening to these people. And a lot of them have been nurses that come by and talk to me, and they're so excited. And that, it's so thrilling to be able to talk with them, and they ask me questions like you did. Just interesting. I can share some of the things with them that I learned.
I'm not trying to put a thought in your head if you don't agree with this, just an idea. Have you ever thought about the possibility that women like you and your sister, two of the 300,000 American women who put a uniform on in World War II, blazed a trail for others to follow, that you helped create opportunities for women today?
Yes, because I've been told that. Somebody just told me here when I was sitting there. Thank you for setting the groundwork for us to be there. And, you know, as I said earlier, we just thought we were doing, you know, what we had been trained to do at that point in time, and we didn't think we were doing anything special. Right. And now it's really nice.
And you just told me not to ask, how does that make you feel?
Yeah.
But how do you feel about that when people say, thank you for helping create opportunities for me?
I'm proud and excited because we did. That's absolutely true.
Well, thank you very much, Betty. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing your story.
Great.
That is Betty Dengis, 98 years old, of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Maybe she'll be there waiting for you when you visit the National Museum of World War II Aviation. Don't forget to find photos of Betty and of that impressive museum online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.